You know, the last few years we've discovered that animal fat is the worst source of cholesterol of anything we eat. And cholesterol is that substance that accumulates in the lining of your arteries, you know, and gives you hardening of the arteries, which finally results in apoplexy or heart failure or some of those things. So, don't eat the fat of the meat. For such fats as you need, get rid of the animal fats that are not causing cholesterol. Leviticus 7, verses 26 and 27 tells you also that you must not eat the blood. The animals that you kill for food must be drained of the blood. We know why now. We know that a good many virus diseases are transmitted by blood. You eat the blood and you get that. You drain the carcass properly and you will escape it. These rules had reason back them. Another rule, as you know, was that you must not eat pork. Well, we know now, of course, that pork is the source of infection with an always terrible and often fatal disease, trichinosis. One of the hardest to diagnose. You see, it consists of tiny little worms that are in the flesh of the pig. And when you eat him, your digestive fluids eat away the little covering around this worm and releases it. So then he gnaws his way through the lining of your digestive system into the blood vessels, and he drifts around until finally he bores his way out through the side of an artery or vein someplace and takes up his lodging there. And it may happen to be in your heart, and you think you've got bad heart trouble. You have, but it's from trichinosis. And it may be in the liver, and you don't realize. It doesn't come out until the coroner performs an autopsy on you after death why you had the liver trouble. But there's more than that. A friend of mine has done a great deal of research on cancer. Among the doctors that he worked with, his name escapes me at the moment, he's quite a famous physician and scientist from McGill University in Kansas. Gruner, that's right, Dr. Gruner of McGill University. And Dr. Gruner has worked out a blood test for cancer. All he needs to have is a microscope slide smear of your blood. He need never have seen you at all. If you do not have cancer, or that is, if the slide does not show the cancer reaction, he can tell you you don't have it. But two things may make it give the typical cancer reaction. One is that you do in fact have cancer. The other is if you have eaten an ordinary serving of pork, and you've had an hour or two time for it to digest and get into the blood, your blood will give the typical cancer reaction. Now, we don't know enough about cancer yet to come out and say definitely pork causes cancer. Maybe it does, maybe not. But when it causes that close to it, and we know that to an absolute certainty, it might very well be that if conditions are about right, pork will sort of pull the trigger. And where you might have escaped cancer, pork produces the result. At any rate, it's something I won't take chances on. Well, now let's take the financial moments for a little here. Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 and 20, lays down a definite rule. To your fellow Israelites, you may not charge any interest on a loan. A loan of money, a loan of property, a loan of anything else, no interest. To the aliens among you, you're under no obligation to lend to them anyway. But if you do, there is no reason why they should use your money with no return at all, and you may make them pay for the privilege. But among your brothers, no interest. Now, We always get too greedy to follow God's law. We get too greedy to let the land rest 1 year out of seven, although that eighth year's crop could be as high as four times the normal crop. We're too greedy to obey the law about interest. Statisticians have computed that the increase in the total wealth of the United States, all that everybody owns, everything that can be valued in terms of money, from 1776 down to date, it has increased at a rate equal to 5% compound interest. In other words, at the end of 1776, you paid your living expenses, you paid your debts, and you had $100 savings. At the end of 1777, you'd be worth $105. At the end of 1778, after all your living expenses and debts were paid, you'd have savings of $110.25, and so on. That's the rate at which the total of everybody's wealth accumulates. All right. I think it's safe to say that businesses which are operated at least partly on borrowed capital are probably, on the average, no more successful than the average of businesses generally. Who gets your 5%? Well, now, if you want to borrow money just for gambling on the stock market, and you can make the bank really believe that that's all you're going to do with it, you can borrow for as little as 1% a year for a completely sterile, futile operation in which all you can accomplish is to profit yourself at the cost of somebody else's loss. But if you want money for some useful purpose, can you get 5%? Tell me where. I might like to get some answers. You're very lucky if you can get it for 6. Or 7. And the poor. Remember how God has spoken at times about the oppression of the poor? When the poor and needy want to borrow, they don't get 1% money. They don't get 6% money. They go, the only place they can get it, where they pay 12 to 18 to as high as 40% a year. All right, the total that is produced after paying the costs, including the wages, the total that's produced, what you have left over as profit at the end of the year, all businesses taken together as an average, is 5%. Now, there are some very successful businesses that make more, and there are some that go broke. And the average of them all is this 5%. But remember, the lender has taken all the cream and part of the skim milk, too. And that's why a great many of these businesses go broke. But the lender is the one who gets rich. Now, does that mean that if you've got some money saved up, the Bible says you can't invest it? No. It says this. You're not investing it, you're following God's law, in the form of a loan on interest. In other words, instead of buying bonds, you'll be buying stock. You will be a part owner in the business, and you will share in its profits. And if God's law were followed, those profits would be greater because they wouldn't be siphoned off by the money lenders as interest. In other words, the Bible recognizes that after you have saved something, you are entitled to have it put to work profitably. But in God's way, not in the Jews' way. Then there's the sabbatic year of release of debt. Every seventh year, the burden of those debts that have proved unpayable is to be canceled. Now, it doesn't mean that you're entitled to borrow with no intention of repaying and wait for the year of release. It doesn't mean that you can borrow with good intentions till you get the money in your hands and then change your mind and say, oh well, what does it matter? There's no hurry. The year of release is coming pretty soon. You have to be honest. You have to pay your debts to the extent that you can. But every seventh year, the burden of these unpayable debts is to be canceled. And do you think that's a natural law or not? We won't do it the easy way. And God said we'd be prosperous if we did. You know what happens when a depression comes along? The burden of the unpayable debts is wiped out sometimes by formal bankruptcy proceedings in federal court. Sometimes by just the statute of limitation runs on it. The debt becomes outlawed, to use the common term. But it isn't collected, is it? Every seventh year, let me read to you a list of some of our depressions. 1893, 1900, 1907. The next was due in 1914 and conditions were really terribly bad in 1913. 1921, and we got it right on time. 1928, and in Europe it did come then, and we kidded ourselves out of it. It was really here, but we pretended not until 1929. It was due next in 1935, and we did have a Roosevelt depression lower than the rest of it in 35. It was due again in 1942, but we had the war prosperity whereby we kidded ourselves that by not only spending all of our own savings, but all of our children's and grandchildren's, we become prosperous. 1949, and we had some. 1956, and we had some. And then the next 7 years, 1962, and you remember our Kennedy Depression? Every seventh year. Does God know what he's talking about, or doesn't he? Then, there was the Jubilee year. After seven of these sabbatical year things, seven sevens are 49, then the 50th year, the Jubilee year. Those of you who remember the history you learned in school remember that the Roman Empire collapsed into ruin, largely for one thing. It was no longer a nation of sturdy, independent farmers. It was a nation of city rabble, living on the dole. Give us bread and circuses, remember? And there was no longer the force of character to defend what they had. You remember Rome had been the one that conquered all the known world. And now they couldn't even defend their own self. And this was to prevent that. The law was this. As to city residential property, you could sell that. Now, you had the right to redeem it and buy it back within 1 year, but not after that. In other words, if you were just up against a temporary bad situation, you might have to sell your home to get through it. But when you got your money again, you could buy it back within a year. But your city home was not what made your living. So if you had to buy some other home in its place later, that was no great calamity. But the farms, that was the source of the living for yourself and your family. You could not sell nor mortgage your farm for a longer period than until the next Jubilee year. Now, if last year was the Jubilee year, well, here was 49 years to go. You could sell it for that period. If next year was the Jubilee year, all you had you could sell was the rest of this year. Now remember, as to farmland, you could redeem it at any time that you got the money. Or your nearest relative, your next of kin, could redeem it for you if you didn't have the money and he had. Now, you got hard up. You mortgaged your farm and it was foreclosed. All right. At the time it was foreclosed, there were 20 years left to run until the next Jubilee year. Well, after 5 years, you raised the money to redeem it. Well, your creditor had had the profits of 5 years' use of the land after he foreclosed it. 1/4 of that 20 years. He'd already repaid himself out of that. So, when you came to redeem, you paid him for the remaining 3/4 of the time that he might have held it under his foreclosure. In other words, if you redeemed, you redeemed in proportion to the unexpired time until the next Jubilee year. But at that Jubilee year, you came back to your farm and you didn't pay one penny, you took it over. Do you remember when the Depression hit, the last of the 20s and the early 30s, and the terrible situation we had in the farming states of the Midwest with the foreclosures and the farms there? You couldn't have had that kind of situation under God's laws. Incidentally, our Liberty Bell, you know, got its name because cast in the metal around the rim of that bell was this quotation from Leviticus 25:10. It says that at the beginning of this Jubilee year, proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. What we should have been doing. Well, I've mentioned another thing. God said, you know, that if we followed His law, we'd be the head, not the tail. One of His laws is that no alien can hold public office. You know, they're trying to make it a great virtue now that we can't discriminate against anybody because of race, religion, or national origin. In other words, one of these evil Jews can come in here from Russia and take over, and we have to give him all the rights of a born citizen. And we're violating God's law. Very plainly, Deuteronomy 17:15, one from among thy brethren shalt thou set over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee which is not thy brother. And that word stranger is the Hebrew word nokri, which means one of alien race. Not just somebody you hadn't been formally introduced to. One of alien race. Remember, among the punishments for disobeying God's law that was listed, the curses that would come upon us, it said, the stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high. He shall be the head and thou shalt be the tail. And now we're governed by this Russian Jew, Walt Rostov, as a curse because we violated God's law. Now we're pulling in our horns, we're running in shameful and abject terror from all the savages of the earth.
Yeah.
And we're violating God's law again. Even our preachers, you know, like to preach in lofty indignation about the evils of colonialism, and they're ministers of Satan, not of God. They don't know their Bible. They couldn't utter these lies if they did. Isaiah 54, verses 2 and 3. Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations. Spare not. Lengthen thy cords and strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the nations. All right, Genesis 27, verses 28 and 29. Let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Be lord over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee, and blessed be he that blesseth thee. Genesis 28, verse 14. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And our rule over them was a blessing, as we're seeing demonstrated now. Deuteronomy 4, verses 7 and 8. For what nation is there so great? Who hath God so nigh unto them as Yahweh our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great which hath statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day. It was our job to conquer and rule these savage peoples and bring this law there. Do you think these jungle savages have the intelligence or the education to follow these things because we go there and preach at them? Of course not. They have to be given a demonstration where they are compelled to obey it and get the results. Isaiah 43, verse 10 to 12. Ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, not the servant of these other races. God says, my servant, that ye may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, neither shall there be after me. I, even I, am Yahweh, and beside me there is no Savior. I have declared and I have saved and I have showed when there was no strange God among you. Therefore ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am God. And that was our job. When we did colonize, and I don't apologize for the word one bit, we brought to these savage nations the only civilization they knew. China was in peace. The warlords didn't rule it, and the communists didn't rule it when we kept order there. Africa, we kept down cannibalism pretty well. You can't civilize a Negro any more than you can civilize a chimpanzee. But we kept them out of mischief. You know, the circuses have proved that you can teach either a chimpanzee or a Negro to ride a bicycle. But all the eons of time have not sufficed for the Negro to invent the wheel. No, you can't civilize them. But you can at least make them behave like tamed animals instead of wild ones. And we did it. And they were better off, you know. Well, if you don't already subscribe to U.S. News and World Report, you ought to. This week's number is especially good. It's dated July 1st. It tells how all these other nations who, we're told, look down their noses at us because we discriminate against Negroes here, and it tells the kind of discrimination they have in their own country, which usually consists in bloodshed and not merely wanting separate eating places. They're going back to the jungle from which for a little time we took them. We withdrew the restraining influence we had there, which kept relative peace in the earth among these peoples. And you know, it's quite possible that that very thing is the fulfillment of one of the rather obscure passages in Scripture. Now, there are some of these things you have to wait to see the whole thing happen before you can identify it completely. And I'm not setting myself up as infallible, but I see something here that interests me greatly. You remember in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, Paul starts out warning these people that there would be false rumors started that Christ had already returned. People would even say, oh yes, I read that in a letter from Paul. And he said, don't you believe it. It isn't going to happen this soon. Something else has to happen first. And he said this, and it's a little clearer in some of the modern English translations, and I'll read it from Moffat. It will not come till the rebellion takes place, first of all. Some of the other translations say the apostasy. And our churches certainly demonstrate that here to the hill. It will not come till the rebellion takes place, first of all, with the revealing of the lawless one, the doomed one, the adversary who vaunts himself above and against every so-called God or object of worship, actually seating himself in the temple of God with the proclamation that he is God. Do you not remember how I used to tell you this when I was with you? Well, you can recall now what it is that restrains him from being revealed before the appointed time. For the secret force of lawlessness, your King James Version says the mystery of iniquity, for the secret force of lawlessness is at work already, only it cannot be revealed until he who at present restrains it is removed. Then shall the lawless one be revealed. Now you see how conditions are developing in the world today. You see how they're rising into that climax, and to the extent that it is a specific individual lawless one. You remember Dr. Swift has mentioned to you that rather remarkable report from de Courcy on that man in Europe, Colonel Greer mentioned it here tonight, who appears to be the very personification of evil. And only now are the conditions developing to the point where he can take over for total evil. That which restrained was our influence, the United States, Britain, our influence as the big colonial powers who kept peace in the world. That which restrained has been removed, and conditions now are ripe for him to be revealed. Well, destiny is going to happen, even the bad part of it. It's nothing to our credit that it does. God put us here to prevent these things from happening. We haven't done our job with the result. That the only thing that can prevent the total extermination of all good on the earth is for God to take over and do it himself. He'll do it, he said so, and he will. But he's going to ask a lot of us, what were you doing while all this went on? We few are fortunate that we can tell him, well, we were in there pitching. We didn't have enough of a team with us to win the game, but we put in our 2 cents worth anyway. So as I said, all these are the laws of God, natural laws. If we follow them as a matter of destiny, we reap the good. And if we disobey them, then as a matter of destiny, we pay the penalty. Now, individually, people can still get their salvation, yes. But if you live in such a city as Chicago, or Atlanta, or Los Angeles, it's kind of cold comfort to think that someday in another life you will have your salvation when still you have to live in this kind of a city. That's where the laws of God apply. That's where you could have the benefit of living in a real heaven on earth, and instead we've violated them and we live in a hell on earth. You can't outwit destiny. Today, my subject is The Laws of God Would Stop Crime. Today, I want to discuss some of God's criminal law in the Bible. Our criminal laws today are very imperfect. The penalty imposed usually seems to have little to do with the crime, and it often leaves the criminal with the impression that he is being persecuted rather than justly punished. Also, for the more serious crimes, the penalty is not decided until long after the criminal has been sent to prison. So again, all connection seems to be lost. God's laws are simple and direct, and nobody can mistake the reason for the penalty and the justice of it. First, let's consider God's laws concerning theft. Why do some people steal? Obviously, in order to make a profit, to gain by the theft. If the amount stolen is big enough, the thief may be willing to spend a few months or years in prison for it. But God's law takes the profit out of theft. The thief loses. He does not gain. Leviticus 6, verses 1 to 5 provides that one who wrongfully withholds from the owner property entrusted to him for safekeeping, or property which he has found, must not only restore the thing to the owner, but must also pay him one-fifth of the value of the thing. But a true thief, one who got the property wrongfully in the first place, really takes a loss. If the stolen thing is recovered intact in his hands, he must restore double the amount of his theft. That's provided in Exodus 22, verses 4 and 9. But if he has consumed the stolen thing, or sold, or otherwise disposed of it, he must restore from 4 to 5 times the amount he stole. That really takes all the fun out of it, doesn't it?
But suppose the thief is defiant. Suppose he says, well, I can't pay it, so what are you going to do about it? God's law can do something about it. The defiant thief is sold into slavery for enough to pay what he owes. Suppose he owes $100. He is auctioned off after this fashion. Who will bid $100 for 1 week of this man's labor? If the thief is repentant and really wants to make amends for the wrong he has done, he probably will be a good worker, and possibly someone will bid $100 for a week of his labor. But suppose he is still sullen and defiant. It'll take a lot more than 1 week to get $100 worth of work out of him. There will be no bidders for 1 week, maybe none for a month's time, or even several months. The thief's own attitude can make it either easier or harder on himself, and the degree of punishment is exactly proportioned to what he needs. Also, the injured party receives some compensation for all his trouble and for the time he lost the use of his property. Again, consider the crimes of assault and battery and mayhem, inflicting bodily injury on another. Today, the law shows no connection between the crime and the punishment. Courts get in the habit of using the same routine penalty for all crimes, even though there is a great difference between the injury inflicted in the different cases. But God's law exactly proportions the punishment to the wrongful offense. The wrongdoer receives the same injury he inflicted on his victim. If he knocked out a tooth, he loses his own. If he broke an arm, his own is broken, and so on. The moral is clear. If you value your own hide, leave your neighbors alone. If you don't want your own arm broken, don't wrongfully attack someone and break his arm. Even the dullest criminal can understand this. People of very philosophical mind, able to understand the connection between a violation of Section 240 of the California Penal Code and a fine of $25 imposed by the court some weeks later, these usually are not the ones who do violate it. The ones who do are those who are dull of wit but sharp of temper and who need some restraint. They can get the point of God's law much better. That is why God's law provided the same injury as the penalty in Exodus 21, verses 22 to 25, and Leviticus 24, verses 19 and 20. Once in a while, there is a case of a man who seeks to injure his enemy by making a false accusation against him, trying to get the law to punish his enemy for something which he never did. Again, God's law provides the right answer in Deuteronomy 19, verses 16 to 20. The false accuser receives the same punishment he tried to have wrongfully inflicted on his enemy, whatever that punishment might be. If he falsely accused his enemy of a crime punishable by a flogging, he himself was flogged, and so forth. Our own California Penal Code, Section 128, adopts a part of this rule. It provides that anyone who, by perjury, causes the execution of an innocent person is punishable by death. There are many other crimes, very serious crimes, which are very frequently committed under our modern law and which are becoming more common every year. I will not bore you with the statistics on how many murders, rapes, and robberies are committed every hour of every day in this country. Besides, they would be last year's statistics and not nearly as bad as this year's record. But these vast numbers of crimes are not committed by a large number of people. On the contrary, a comparatively few people, nearly all of them habitual criminals, commit this great number of crimes. Our modern law has become so distorted that its purpose no longer seems to be to protect society against the criminal, but just to furnish highly paid jobs for a lot of fuzzy-minded do-gooder social workers to coddle the professional criminal. God's law does not make this mistake. Its purpose is to protect the innocent from the wrongdoer. For willful murder, the penalty is death. See Leviticus 24, verse 17, Numbers 35, verses 16 to 21, and Deuteronomy 19, verses 11 to 13. One who killed by accident, however, without any wrongful intent, was not punished, and he was protected from any revenge on the part of the dead person's relatives. See Numbers 35, verses 10 to 15 and 22 to 25, and Deuteronomy 19, verses 4 to 6. For kidnapping and also for rape, the punishment was death. See Deuteronomy 22, verses 25 to 27, and Deuteronomy 24, verse 7. It was intended that these vicious and loathsome crimes should be stamped out. Under God's law, we could not have seen the spectacle of a man guilty of these crimes delaying his punishment for many years until he exhausted the long-suffering patience of the courts. The penalty is to be death, swift and certain. The Bible says, "So shalt thou put the evil away from among you, and those which remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you." Adultery also was punishable with death. How that would depopulate Hollywood! Various minor crimes could be punished by flogging, but not more than 40 lashes. The state of Delaware had a statute authorizing flogging of robbers and burglars, but it had not been used for a long time. So in the year 1922, the situation became so bad that the insurance companies writing robbery and burglary insurance all agreed not to issue any more such insurance in the state of Delaware. This suddenly awoke the conscience of the Delaware courts to have the robbers and burglars flogged, and in 1 year these crimes were reduced to less than one-third of their former rate. Under God's law, habitual criminals who could not be reformed by such penalties were not allowed to continue to harm the innocent, nor were they supported at public expense for life. Death was the penalty for habitual crime. This alone would take care of almost our entire crime problem today, for most of our serious crimes are the work of habitual criminals. We still see large gangs of criminals running free in every large city, while our law must wait until after they have committed the robberies and murders they are planning. We must always sacrifice innocent victims on the altar of crime. God's law would not do that. These criminal gangs would all be destroyed because they are habitual criminals, and the honest people of the community would then have peace and safety. The Bible records that when our ancestors enforced and obeyed God's laws, they had peace and prosperity, and they were respected by the other nations. But Israel was condemned to captivity and exile because they abandoned the laws of God and followed the statutes of Omri, as the 6th chapter of Micah records. Today, we too are keeping the statutes of Omri, and we suffer the penalty in a frightful rate of crime, which is steadily getting worse. We have the record of 3,000 years of experience. Man's laws always fail, but God's laws alone will bring peace, prosperity, and safety. When will we learn to make God's laws the law of this land, and thereby reap the benefits thereof?
This tape was produced by Your Heritage and Pastor Bertrand Comparé. We have much more information in written form and tape recordings, both reel and cassette. We offer this material to assist the personal ministries of those who are called to awaken Yahweh's Israel sheep to the truth of His Word and the necessity for national repentance. Feel free to call upon us for personal consultation. We welcome your suggestions as to how Your Heritage can more effectively spread the gospel of the kingdom. Many people are meeting in their homes using Pastor Comparé's material as a basis for their study. Such groups represent a healthy return to the early assemblies of believers and offers those who finally see the light and come out of the Babylonian church system a place to worship with other believers. We would hope that such meetings would also provide the nucleus of support for our radio broadcast in your area, and we shall be happy to cooperate with you in this regard. As you know, Your Heritage is not associated with any organization. As our congregation, we depend upon your tithes and offerings to pay the expenses of spreading the gospel. We try to merit your support.
Please send all correspondence to our new private zip code, Your Heritage, San Diego, California, 92116-0100. And now goodbye, and may God richly bless you.